So, it seems to be working fine. Last week, a little review of last week, we talked about the church fathers, and I did not want to... the one thing I wanted to avoid last week was to talk about the church fathers and make it sound like a witch hunt, okay? When we talk about anti-Semitism, obviously, when you get to the topic of the church fathers, you're going to find a lot of negative, a lot of really, really abrasive comments and writings. But at the same time, you cannot just get rid of everything they said, because they contributed to the faith in many good ways. And I started with that last week. I give at least three reasons why we should remember the church fathers in some good light. There's a few things they did. For instance, the first thing we talked about, and that's we're doing a review now, so it's not in your notes for today, it's last week. New Testament usage. It was said that if the New Testament was completely destroyed, we could recreate it simply from the quoting of Scripture of the church fathers. That's quite a statement to make. So that's a good thing. The other one is that a New Testament distribution. You can find the New Testament in a lot of areas of the known world back then because of the spreading geographically of all the church fathers and where they lived. Like Clement was in Rome, Irenaeus in France, there were others in Syria, Africa, Ephesus, Rome, Asia Minor, and other countries. So they were spread out in a large geographical area, and at the same time, we're working on the New Testament and writing on it, so it not only gave us the ability to quote, to rebuild the New Testament if it was lost, but also it gave exposure to the New Testament in a large geographical area. But one more thing that we also discussed, and that's important, they also, the church fathers contributed to many campaigns against corruption, false teaching, and heresy. And that is probably, I would say, one of the main reasons why we still go to them today. They helped shape the faith as we know it today. Not shape in a sense that they say, well, we're going to make it our way, we're going to change things. They helped shape it in a sense that they helped maintain its purity the best we could. In the process, of course, things were done that were not always so pure, mistakes were made, but many heresies that were infiltrating the church early on, first century on, were stopped because of the church fathers' serious look at Scripture and respect for Scripture, at least in some areas, some of the Bible. Some other areas, they were not really a good exegetes, like for Israel and the Jewish people, but we already know that, and we're going to find out more about it as we go. But here, the false teaching was really rampant in the New Testament, and it continued after the closing of the canon, and so their contribution against corruption, false teaching, and heresy was something that we cannot dismiss. It was very important. This being said, a lot of mistakes were made by the church fathers, and of course, the main reason why they made mistakes is due to their interpretation of Scripture that was allegorical. And the interesting part that we looked at last week is that they got their method of interpretation from rabbis. They wanted to study the Old Testament, who went to local rabbis, who gave them some information about methods of interpretation, four of them, and going from very literal to very mystical and everything in between. And that's how these church fathers started to develop their own methods of interpretation based on what they learned from the rabbis. And then they not only interpret the Old Testament that way, based on what they had learned, but also use those methods learned to do interpretation of the New Covenant. So the result was, you know, allegorical exegesis of the text, and the sky's the limit. And then, of course, it was applied to Israel and the church. And it started to paint a picture of Israel, where Israel and the Jewish people were wrong. And that's important to remember. At that time, Israel and the Jewish people are simply wrong. They're not mean, they're not evil, they're not possessed, they're not everything that they're going to become within 5 centuries, and then it just grows after that. It's just they're wrong. So we're talking about theological anti-Semitism or ideological anti-Semitism or anti-Judaism. You could even argue for not calling anti-Semitism back then anti-Semitism, but simply anti-Judaism. The difference being that anti-Judaism is simply against an ideology or a faith, not against the people or the country. Today, it's all-encompassing. The people, the land, the customs, the practices, the religion, everything that has anything to do with Jewish is under the curse of anti-Semitic people. So back then, we could say it was only anti-Judaism. And of course, it's morphed over several centuries. Then we listed many of the church fathers, the early church fathers, not all of them, but we listed many of them with some of their infamous statements. We started with Ignatius, the bishop of Antioch, first century, continued with Justin Martyr and his dialogue with Trypho, a very important work where he had a dialogue with a Jewish rabbi where he was trying to prove to him that Judaism was the wrong religion. And then we continued with Tertullian, 160 to 20 AD. We also wrote a piece called Against the Jews. I guess that says it all. Then Origen of Alexandria, 185 to 54. He wrote some pretty nasty pieces against the Jewish people. Then we moved on to the granddaddy of them all, John Chrysostom, still known today within a Christian circle as the golden-mouthed orator. He was a famous preacher, and he wrote some really, really, really very abrasive, vitriolic statements against the Jewish people. It's in your notes. If you were not here last week, I recommend you go through them. Then we talked about Augustine, who also damaged the Jewish reputation, and I think that's where we stopped. We realized that all those church fathers, and there's just a few of them, and again, they're not all bad. Just like when we get to Martin Luther, it's not going to be all bad. Let's just crucify Martin Luther. But we need to realize what parts of his teaching and his writing is against the Jewish people, because guess what? The Jewish people know it very well. And for us to say, well, Martin Luther, don't mess with Martin Luther because he's a father of the Reformation, so everything he did was perfect. No, it was not. But, you know, some good, some bad. We have to recognize what was good and, you know, take it to the bank and recognize what was bad. Same with the church fathers. They contributed many things. They helped us maintain and organize the faith and systematize and fight against heresy. But they also, for some reason, based mainly on allegorical interpretation, they started to paint a picture of Israel and the Jewish people that was opposite of the church, and it was enemies of the church, and it got to be pretty bad, and it's getting you know, worse and worse over the centuries. So today we're going to go on lesson 4, which is the last lesson in our series, in our first section on anti-Semitism. We'll have two more sections, but this is our first section right now, from faulty biblical interpretation to crippling laws. And I want to talk a little bit in introduction about the Roman Empire, briefly, just give you some facts about the Roman Empire. It started in mid-first century. It covered about 6.5 million square kilometers. I was going to put miles, but I was born in France, so I thought, I'll put in kilometers. It's about 4.7 or so, 4.3, something like that, million miles. It's huge. Though it's split into two kingdoms, kind of like Israel and Judah, and the West collapsed in 476 and the East in 1453. But that's the both are part of the original Roman Empire. It profoundly affected different areas, just about every area, as it says in your first paragraph here or on the screen. Language, religion, architecture, philosophy, and law. The Roman Empire affected these areas and others, but mostly these very, very much in a very strong way. The Western Roman Empire collapsed in 476. The Eastern collapsed in 1453. In the midst of that Western Roman Empire, a man emerged that is going to be critical to our to our study tonight, and his name is Emperor Constantine. He is the one who introduced Christianity as the religion of the state. He said, okay, it's okay to be a Christian. Up to that point, Christians were being persecuted by the empire and by the pagans. And Jews were either protected or persecuted, but not necessarily, it was not that bad yet for the Jewish people. Not necessarily worse than for the Christians. Then all of a sudden, Constantine becomes a Christian, quote, end quote, and he makes Christianity the religion of the state. Those are the dates for him, 272, 337. He's responsible for two major, the Council of Nicaea and the Edict of Milan. And the Council of Nicaea was 325, so he did that basically 12 years before his death. And I believe in 325 is when he finally reunited both kingdoms, the Roman Empire, East and West, into one. So he was quite a powerful general, a great military achiever. He was able to reunite the two empires. And 315, Constantine published the Edict of Milan after publicly claiming to be a Christian. Until then, Christianity was the enemy of the state. It now becomes one and the same with the state, and the persecution of Christians by the state comes to a stop. Yet, it didn't stop Christians from killing other Christians, as much carnage took place amongst church members with differing views. We'll see this in a minute when we talked about what was inside the Council of Nicaea. We're going to find out that, if somebody had an Orthodox Trinitarian view of Father, Son, Holy Spirit, you know, the Godhead, three in one, three persons, so on and so forth, and somebody said, well, maybe the Holy Spirit is just this, or maybe Jesus is not fully God, or he's created, or then they would create riots and people would kill one another. So it's, it's different now within Christianity, of course, but back then it was pretty bloody. So about Constantine, I just want to reiterate what I told you. I told you, okay, 315, the Edict of Milan, 325, the Council of Nicaea. And also Constantine it was during his reign that the cross became the Christian symbol. Before that, it was not the official Christian symbol. I'm not sure what it was, maybe the fish, maybe something else. But the cross became the official Christian symbol that after that was on all different items and elements of Christian life, like the shield for the Crusaders and other different places, and not always in the most positive way, but it was become the symbol of Christianity. Constantine contributed to the advancement of Christendom by funding the construction of large cathedrals and basilicas, such as the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem or Old Saint Peter Basilica in Rome. Christians and clergy greatly benefited from his conversion to Christianity. By 325, he had become the sole emperor of the Roman Empire. The problem with Constantine is that he did not just convert to Christianity and made it the religion of the state. He compromised. He said, hey, I like this Christian belief system, but I'm okay if you continue doing a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and you dabble in this and dabble in that, as long as you call yourself a Christian and you follow the main line, the main tenets of Christianity, I'm going to look the other way. He didn't say it that way, but he acted that way. So there was a mix of paganism and Christianity that became the new Christianity of the state at the time. And that makes for a dangerous mix here, as we're going to see. Is we're going to see what happens after that. So he originally was satisfied with placing Christianity and heathendom on equal footings. After he came to power and made Christianity the state-approved religion, he did not repress heathen practices. His leanings for a more pagan Christianity are clearly showed in the results of the first ecumenical council at Nicaea in 325 AD. The council was originally convened to fight the heresy introduced by Arius, known as Arianism, about Yeshua having a beginning because of statements found in scriptures such as John 3:18. He who believes in him is not judged. He who does not believe has been judged already because he has not believed in the name of the only begotten Son of God. See, only begotten Son of God to Arius meant that Jesus had a beginning. He was the only Son of God, thus he had to be created. If you're created, you have a beginning. If you have a beginning, you have not eternally coexisted within the Godhead, thus you're lesser than God the Father, then you're not the same. He's not the same in the Trinity, but he's not God. He's not fully God like he would be in the way we understand it from Scripture in Orthodox Trinitarian position. So that position, the Council of Nicaea was convened for that in 325 to fight Arianism, to reinforce the Trinitarian position. It created bloodshed between Christians because some Christians at that point said, like, well, you know, I like what Arius is saying. Not Arian, okay, we got to be careful with the Arian race and everything. We're talking about something completely different. We'll get to that later also. But Arius is saying that, you know, Jesus, based on some of the interpretation of Scripture, he's the Son of God, so he must be created. So some Christians liked it. Big bloodshed, big fights, massacres. But also, like always, every time you have something like this, most of the time, you have something like this started by Christianity or by Christians, like this movement or other councils to fight heresy, or the Crusades originally started to fight the infidels, the Muslims in the Holy Land. You end up getting the Jews caught in the middle. And just the Council of Nicaea had nothing to do with Passover. But Constantine said, hey, you guys, since we're here, okay, let's take a break from this Arianism. This is not verbatim, okay? But let's take a break from this Arianism stuff, and let's talk a little bit about the Passover, because I'm sick of this Jewish Passover. Can we just get rid of it and move on and not do this Passover that we can't relate to with the Jewish people? Can we have our own thing? And they until 325 A.D., until the Council of Nicaea, Jews and Christians celebrated Passover. That's the date where it stopped. And until then, they celebrated Passover. The Jews celebrated Passover, and the Christians celebrated Resurrection Sunday around the time of after Passover. It made a lot of sense. It's the way it should be done. You know, they said, you know what? We want our own thing, so let's start Easter. And from the fertility goddess Ishtar, and in the middle of your page 2, here is a statement from the Council of Nicaea. For it is unbecoming beyond measure that on this holiest of festivals we should follow the customs of the Jews. Henceforth let us have nothing in common with this odious people. We ought not therefore to have anything in common with the Jews. Our worship follows as a more convenient course, we desire, dearest brethren, to separate ourselves from the detestable company of the Jews. How then could we follow these Jews who are almost certainly blinded? That's a small section of the putting an end to the Passover in the Council of Nicaea. Right above that, I put this little note saying that Nicaea was the genuine birthplace. You could put birthplace and birth date of the Catholic Church, as a direct result of the compromising between a union of church and state. So it really is the birth date and birth place and birth date of the church, of the Catholic Church, so to speak. So replace the Passover with Easter, Council of Nicaea, birthplace of the Catholic Church, and introduce also anti-Jewish laws. Under his rule and within the two edicts, 315 and 325, the 325 is Nicaea, the Edict of Milan, Italy, is in 315, laws began to be passed against the Jews. They were only the starting point of a long strain of judicial streamlining aimed at controlling, ostracizing, and eventually annihilating the Jews. A few are listed here, and here are some of them. Death penalty for circumcision of slaves. That Jewish people had slaves and they would want to circumcise them. Why? What's the big fuss with that? Why would they want to do it, and why would anybody care? Think about it. Jewish people had slaves. They wanted to be able to use these slaves, just like Christians had slaves. Okay, it was not just a Jewish thing, but they wanted to be able to use them and also feed them and take care of them under their own authority and under their own roof, so to speak. So if you circumcise them, back then they believed that they would make them Jewish. So they could feed them the same food, it would be easier to take care of them. at this, by the same token, the other side of the coin is that Christians would see, ah, you know what? They're taking non-Jewish slaves, making them slaves, and then turning them into Jews. That was bad. That was, again, taking Christians or non-Jews and making them into Jews. Now, of course, they're both wrong, because you cannot make somebody a Jew by circumcising them. That's just, circumcision is a sign of the covenant, of the Abrahamic covenant for Jewish people, but it doesn't make somebody a Jew. It just, it's an act it's a sign of the covenant when you're Jewish. But here, there was a fear of losing people to Jewish people, to the Jewish faith, so death penalty for circumcision of slaves. Jews were forbidden to own Christian slaves. After that, they said, you know what, no more Christian slaves for the Jews. Death penalty for embracing the Jewish faith. Any Christian, any non-Jew, deciding to follow Judaism would be taking their own life in their hands. And then, of course, those converting them. Death penalty for Jews versed in the law who aided them. Death penalty for marriages between Jews and Christians. Death penalty for attending Jewish religious assemblies. If you are not Jewish and then your Jewish peasant, farmer, friend, neighbor in the village say, hey, we're having a Hanukkah party. You want to come? You better think twice, because you're going to a Jewish religious assembly, you're not Jewish, death penalty. That was, sorry? No latkes for you, that's right. So that the Council of Nicaea introduced many of those laws on top of just fighting heresy, which fighting heresy was good. Now, in the Catholic Encyclopedia, consider the source, it says, some bishops, blinded by the splendor of the court, went so far as to laud the emperor as an angel of God, as a sacred being, and to prophesy that he would, like the Son of God, reign in heaven. Talking about Emperor Constantine as he organized the Council of Nicaea. Constantine's measure against the Jews were comparatively mild, yet they announced the end of the toleration that Jews had enjoyed under the Roman Empire. Until that time, the Jew was some sort of a second-class citizen, somewhat protected by law, but merely tolerated. Their status was very similar to the one of the Dhimmis, who were second-class citizen under Islam. That these somewhat good old days were about to come to an end. Anybody not familiar with a Dhimmi is? Do you know what a Dhimmi is? A Dhimmi is, and I put a little footnote, you can refer to it and go on, read the article online. A Dhimmi is a people of the contract, or people of the Dhimma, which is, it means contract. It's a non-Muslim living under Muslim authority. It's a second-class citizen, tolerated by Islam, but not on equal footing with the rest of the Muslim community. So if you move to, as Americans here, if we move to Saudi Arabia, for business, we have a, you know, there's an American business and you work there, you are tolerated, but you're a Dhimmi. You are not a Muslim in Saudi Arabia, so you would be a Dhimmi. You would be a second-class citizen, and you would not benefit from the same rights as Muslim would benefit from. And it will, just a little side note, if in this country, in America here, most of us might be the only exception, we're born here. If we don't become a little more vocal about the rise of Islam, we are going to become Dhimmis in our own country. Because Sharia law will pass and will push and push and push to the place where Muslims will take over in this country. They already have in some areas of Michigan. In Dearborn. Dearborn is, I wouldn't set foot there. But we think about it. We would become Dhimmis in our own country. That doesn't make sense. Yet, most people don't say anything about it, but that's a jewel. You know, we'll get back to this later on in the class when we talk about modern anti-Semitism. We're not there yet. We have more damage to do. So, Paul's advice to Gentiles in Romans 11 to provoke the Jews to jealousy was completely ignored, as it continues to be ignored, and the Jewish people were more provoked to anger at best. Romans 11:11, I say then they did not stumble as to fall, did they? May never be. But by their transgression, salvation has come to the Gentiles to make them jealous. So the hostile attitude of the Christianized state would only get worse under Constantine's sons. But it owed its origin to Constantine. That's the fact. And an interesting little fact here, we don't want to make more of this than needs to be, but Constantine died in 337 on Shavuot, on the Feast of Weeks. which is 49 days after Passover. 49 plus one. 7 weeks, the Feast of Weeks, 7 weeks after Passover plus one day. That's 49 plus one, you get 50. The Feast of Shavuot, the Feast of Weeks. 50 is also how we got Shavuot to be translated into Pentecost. It's the same. It comes from the Greek, from the word 50. So on Shavuot, 49 days plus one day after Passover, the one who said no more Passover died. I don't want to make more of it. I just thought it was, you know, a little bit of a coincidence maybe. I read this thing yesterday that said, it says God post-it notes, little God messages that somebody sent me, and it said, and I loved it, it said, a coincidence is simply God deciding to remain anonymous. I thought it was kind of cute. So we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk about the Codex Theodosianus or Theodician Code. Let's take a short break. All right, now we're going to continue with, for a little bit now, we're going to talk about a very important code that was developed over a period of about 140 years, the Codex Theodosianus in Latin, which basically means the Theodician Code, or the Code of Emperor Theodosius. Okay, so Codex Theodosianus, for the sake of me not losing my mind, we'll call it the CT for the rest of this class, okay? The CT. So the most... Yes. Yeah, they keep dying and the new ones come, and I can't keep up with the Roman Empire. But here's the Theodosian Code. And this is one of two, this one and the Latin and Greek Code of Justinian, which is another emperor, came later on the scene. They are the two major volumes. If you want to really, unless you want to read on do a little research on the Edict of Milan or the Council of Nicaea. By the way, somebody mentioned, Paul mentioned during the break, that it is true that during the Council of Nicaea, the Nicene Creed was developed, which we still hear about and talk about in Christianity today. So, and that was not a bad thing. So if you want to read about all the laws that were passed over a period of a couple of hundred years, you're looking at 313 through 453, and then Justinian 534, you're looking at a little over 200 years, two centuries. Those two bodies of work, the CT and the Code of Justinian, it will include a lot of laws passed about a lot of things, and of course, not only about the Jewish people, but they will include some, and many of them, about the Jewish people. Both of these huge works are crucial to the understanding of the history of the progressive deterioration of Jewish rights listed by dates below are some of the laws listed in the CT over the years and chronologically. The codex, when I say the city, I'm thinking like in the city, you know, the word city, so I'm not going to say that. In the Codex Theodosianus, or Theodosian Code. While the Theodosian Code did not always spell bad news for the Jewish people, it put in place many of the early laws that would be later improved upon and or enforced. While Judaism was still considered a tolerated religion, the second-class citizen status of the Jewish people under the Roman Empire and the Catholic Church was starting to take root. The concept of the dhimmi. Now, the dhimmi is a purely Muslim concept. Okay, we don't use the word dhimmi to talk about second-class citizen about the Jewish people under Christianity in those centuries. I was just comparing the two, so you can't use that word for Jews under Christianity. But so the Theodosian Code was developed between 313 and 453, and there were four distinct groups of laws. They're listed in the middle of page 4 here, and that's important here. Amongst other laws, those that pertain even remotely to the Jewish people fell under four different categories. First, those which established Judaism's basic rights and freedoms. There were laws that actually, within those two bodies of work, that said that that were basically establishing basic rights and freedoms for the Jewish people. Not all of them were Jews are bad, they couldn't do this, they couldn't do that, take this away from them, put him here, take that. Some of them were actually okay, there were just laws that were established to protect Judaism, basic right and freedom. Then there's another group, those which the laws which prohibit injustice and violence, no S there, that's a typo, against Jews and Judaism. A lot of things were starting to happen where people would steal property, break property. Not too many deaths reported in those years, but still a few deaths, but not too many yet. But a lot of, you know, started to see some synagogue being burned and things like that. So laws had to be established to prohibit injustice and violence against the Jews and against Judaism. So that's another group of laws in the codex, in the code. Then laws, the third one is the group, the laws prohibiting anti-Christian practices by Jews. We're no saints, okay? I keep talking about anti-Semitism and how Jewish people were hurt by the Christians and were misunderstood and Bible were misinterpreted and then we wanted to get rid of the Jews and steal their property and break this and do that to them. Jewish people were not completely innocent. There were sightings of cross burning at the time of Purim, the Feast of Purim, in those years when Jewish people were reacting to what the Christians were doing to them. So it was not a, we're victims, we're not doing anything, it's all against us. Some of the Jewish people, justified or not, you know, I mean, their anger was probably, you know, exacerbated by all of what was happening against them. It's never justified, but they were not just standing and doing nothing, say, okay, take our stuff, kill us, hurt us. So there were some responses from the Jewish people and in different ways, in different forms. And because of that, some laws had to be established to prohibit anti-Christian practices by Jews. And finally, a fourth category, probably the most damaging, and that is the one that restrict the Jewish people and restrict Judaism. And that's what would continue to be developed over the centuries after that. You know, restricting Judaism, like you cannot practice Judaism, you cannot convert people to Judaism, you cannot own property if you're Jewish, you cannot hold a regular job if you're Jewish, you have to wear a special kind of clothes if you're Jewish. All those things that would restrict and restrict and restrict. And those were established at that time, enforced during the Middle Ages, as we'll see in part two of our class, and then picked up and enforced at a different level during the Holocaust, or prior to the Holocaust. In the early 30s in Germany, you would see the same laws. There's a great book by Raoul Hilberg, The Destruction of European Jewry, where he lists all those laws that took place, that started at this time in history, and he compares them with how Hitler brought every single one of those laws back, one at a time, progressively, to the point where the Jews had no rights and they were just subhuman animals. Yes? Yes. Right. Right. Absolutely. So, four groups, let me read some of the laws to you. Now, you'll see that not all of them are bad. It's a mixed bag, there's three columns, the year, then the code or the chapter where you can find that law, and then a short description of what the law was all about. Many more in between, many more throughout the code. Huge piece of work, but I just wanted to list. I have a dozen of them that I just want to list to give you a little bit of a sampling of those laws. Question. Well. First of all, there are different years. You know, you're looking at a span of about 140 years. And in that span, as you'll see in that list here, the beginning of my list, I give you things that by the end, by 480 years later, it's rescinded. It's like the opposite. So they say, we're going to let you do that. And then later on, maybe a different emperor, different advisors. We're going to change it because they decide to let the Jewish people do something. And they realize, like, well, that's just not working so well for us. So here's a new law to basically take precedence. And it's just, okay, we're not going to go by that one anymore. The new law is you can no longer do what we told you you could. And now you could, but only if. Or you can only if this, and you take this back. So they kept adding and deleting and changing them. But you're right, the third one seems in conflict with the others, but those are the four groups of laws you see over a period of about 140 years. 321, Jews are allowed to serve on municipal councils. That doesn't look too bad. 330, Jewish priests, rabbis basically, shall be exempt from public service. Jews, 336, Jews are not allowed to harass Jewish converts to Christianity. 339, Jews may not hold Christian slaves, and Jews who circumcise slaves shall be executed. That was a big one. So you're looking at within 17 years now, within 18 years of the beginning here, you're starting to see some pretty serious laws that would demand the taking of a life of a Jewish person if they did not follow that law. 352, persons who join Judaism from Christianity shall have their property confiscated. You notice that if you a Jew might lose their life, a Christian might just lose their property. There's still a difference, double standard, so to speak. Well, the Catholic Church is notorious for control and power and wealth. Okay, the Catholic Church has always looked at controlling that aspect of the church. That's why I always wonder, people always wonder, why are the priests not marrying? Well, if you don't marry, you can't leave. You have anything you own ends up staying with the church. You don't have any descendants. There's just a little side note here, but the Catholic Church is always about power and control, and it has a lot to do with money. So they I'm always leery when I don't want to just paint with a broad stroke and say no Catholic is a Christian, as we understand evangelicals. Back in those days, it was a little different, okay? Back in those days, Christianity was not what it is today. If it's in some bad ways, in some good ways, but the Catholic Church back then was the lines were more blurred, I think, between Catholicism and Christianity, especially until Luther, and then it changes a little bit. But against, even when it changes for the Jews, it's never good. It's good for some people and not for the Jews. 393, the Jewish sect, there's a good one. The Jewish sect is protected by law. No regulation may be passed to ban Judaism, even in the name of Christianity. So in the late 300s, it seems like they had a good, span of time where they kind of liked, they wanted to be nice to the Jewish people. So 397, Jews are not to be insulted. Governors are to be informed when such incidents occur. That sounds like such a minor offense in light of all the other things. Don't insult a Jew, but if you find one circumcising a Christian slave, he dies. Okay, just make sure you kill him without insulting him. I don't know, it just doesn't make any sense. 397, Jewish clergy are allowed to retain their own laws and rituals and are exempt from service as decurion. A decurion is in a Roman army. Roman, it meant a leader of 10 people. That's basically what it meant. 399, revenue collected by Jewish synagogue rulers is to be sent instead to the imperial treasury. So now they're tithing to the church, so to speak. The Jewish people don't tithe the way that Christians do, but now whatever they give to the synagogue, it is transferred to the imperial treasury. 400, Jews and Samaritans are not allowed to serve in the imperial service. Now 400, you see that, and in 321, they're allowed to serve in municipal councils, which is a lot of the same jobs. So things change over a period of 70, 80 years, and they keep changing back and forth, but it usually gets progressively worse. 423, and of course, there's many in between. I'm just picking some of them. Jewish synagogues may not be taken or burnt indiscriminately. If such an incident does occur, they will be compensated. However, they may not build new synagogues, or existing ones may not be improved. So if we burn one of your synagogues, we'll give you a dollar or two, but don't build another one. It's gone, Okay, and if you want to improve upon one, add a room or add a gym, or not a gym, but you know, add an extra room, whatever, you can do that either. Okay. Now that law was passed after an incident that we're going to talk about that marked a very important part of history. We're going to talk about it in a minute. So the I don't think I have anything on the. No, I'm good. This is where I want to be on the screen. Perfect. Okay. So the church fathers had a distorted understanding of biblical Judaism. The monstrosity of Israel was their main concern. As they saw it, Israel had been a continual disappointment to God, who had done so much for them. They needed to separate the evil from the holy, so they started to ostracize the Jewish people. Christianity would soon claim all the virtuous actions of the Old Testament for a kind of pre-existent church. Replacement theology was emerging as a new doctrine. Was not labeled that way, but it was emerging as that new doctrine. All these views influenced the legal enactments made against the Jews early on. Now, there are other key players and important events throughout that history as we kind of wrap up, you know, up to the 5th century or the end of the 4th century. So let me give you a couple more. One of the sons of Constantine, Emperor Constantius the First, I believe, Christian emperor, Christian, quote, end quote, you know, following in the footsteps of his dad, he was actually worse, created a law that made the marriage of a Jewish man to a Christian punishable by death. To both. Not just one, to both. Christian and the Jew. 343 through 381, the Laodicean Synod approved the Canon 38, saying this: it is not lawful, against the law, for Christians to receive unleavened bread from the Jews, nor to partakers of their impiety. Remember, until 325, Passover was shared between Jews and Christians, and possibly even when they were taking communion, the Lord's Supper, they were using unleavened bread as well, based on what happened at Passover. But now it says you can't do that with Jewish people, so don't touch their matzah. Later on in history, a Jewish people will be accused during the Middle Ages. We'll get to that probably in a couple of lessons. Will be accused of using the blood of Christian children to make matzah for Passover. And I will explain to you why it's absolutely ludicrous to even think that if you have a half an education, if you know the Jewish people a little bit. But it starts right there. Then in 367, leave it to the French, Saint-Hilaire of Poitiers referred to the Jews as a perverse people who God has cursed forever. Then in 380, the Bishop of Milan, and there's been more than one Bishop of Milan, obviously, was responsible for the burning of a synagogue, and he referred to it as an act pleasing to God. An act pleasing to God. I mean, it goes all the way, the burning of synagogues goes all the way through, you know, it still happened during the, today actually, you know, you see it today, you know, they tried to bomb them, but they were burning them during the war, they were burning them during the pogroms, big synagogue in Jerusalem during the Crusades. They not only burned the synagogues, they put all the Jews in the community in the synagogue, burned the synagogue, set it on fire, and the Christian crusaders walked around the synagogue on their horses singing Christian hymns, march on Christian soldier or whatever, and letting 1,000 Jews in Jerusalem die. Let me remind you that this is the crusade that was against the Muslims. But hey, we got the Jews in our backyard, let's practice. That was the mentality. We'll get to the crusades later on. Yeah, but it's all kinds of things. So then Cyril, the Bishop of Alexandria, expelled the Jews from that Egyptian city. And of course, Jews were from, you know, throughout the whole history, the concept of a wandering Jew, never welcome in a country. You know, it keeps going like, you know, from country to country to country for a certain amount of time, and then expelled, and they have to go to another one, but never really accepted anywhere. 418, Jerome. Jerome is the he's the one who wrote the Latin Vulgate. The Latin Vulgate is a big, important piece of work. The Latin Vulgate is the translation of the Bible in Latin. And considering that you know, the priest, starting, you know, back then up to 1962 at Vatican II, the priest would do the whole Mass in the Catholic Church in Latin. Of course, nobody understood, which was very, you know, convenient, because they could say whatever they want and then apply whatever law, whatever, but or guilt trip. But Jerome, it's an important piece of work. He translated the whole Bible in Latin. And to this day, it's part of the work that you study if you're a serious student of the Bible. But he also just, hey, what the heck, why not? This is what he said about the synagogue. If you call it a brothel, a den of vice, the devil's refuge, Satan's fortress, a place to deprave the soul, an abyss of every conceivable disaster, or whatever you will, you're still saying less than it deserves. That's a nice place, isn't it? That's what he says of the synagogue. Then in 419 to 519, you start seeing, it's about 30 years here, and it didn't stop there, but there was a surge of it at that time, I guess. Christian mobs destroyed synagogues in Antioch, Daphne, near Antioch, and Ravenna. So now you see what's happening here is Christian antisemitism moves away from the words. Up to now, it was just words. Remember, we talked last week about the anti-Semitism being more anti-Judaism, ideological, intellectual, words against the Jewish people. But now we're starting to see laws being passed and words becoming deeds. And the deeds are going to be to fight the Jewish people. The first we tried to... there is a man, I think it's the same guy, Raoul Hilberg, in his book, The Destruction of European Jewry, he said there was three stages in Jewish history. They can't leave among us. They can't leave among us as Jews. That's this period of time in history. So there were forced conversions. That's what they tried. Then the next step is they can't leave among us. So then we try to push them out and put them in a ghetto, put them in Russia. It's known as, what's known as the Pale of Settlement, the pogroms in that part of Russia where all the Jews live in the shtetl, little villages. So they can't leave among us as Jews. Let's try to convert them. They can't leave among us. Let's push them away. And finally, the third stage was they can't live. Let's kill them. Those are the three stages of anti-Semitism against the Jews, progressive anti-Semitism from where we are right now all the way to today, or to at least the very least to the Holocaust. Although I would venture that it's coming back full force at the level it was at the Holocaust. If we don't pay attention here, but back to the 400, the last of our era here that we're covering tonight. And the last point, actually, Christian anti-Semitism, point four. Christian anti-Semitism moves away from words. With the exception of the savage murder of Hypatia, a Jewish philosopher, in 415 Alexandria, Egypt, by fanatical Christians, anti-Jewish activities were limited to attacks and or destruction of synagogues. And yet, not even that many at that time. It was just starting. Laws have been passed to protect the Jewish people, but they were never fully enforced. Nevertheless, the destruction of synagogues was not quite the common practice that it would become later. Until one incident in Mesopotamia changed everything. And this is the incident, the last thing I want to talk about here. It was in Mesopotamia in 388 when Bishop Callinicus and a Christian mob burned a synagogue. Emperor Theodosius ordered it to be rebuilt by the bishop and the perpetrators as well. And he also, at their own expense, and the bishop, the perpetrators were to be punished. That's what the emperor said. Saint Ambrose, who was the bishop of Milan at the time, I don't know what it is with the bishop of Milan, but they're, you know, all over the place here. He intervened in a letter to the emperor in which he kind of rebuked him, and he said, "The glory of God is concerned in this matter, and that, therefore, he cannot be silent. Shall the bishop be compelled to re-erect a synagogue? Can he religiously do this thing? If he obey the emperor, he will become a traitor to his faith. If he disobey him, a martyr. what real wrong is there? After all, in destroying a synagogue, a home of perfidy, a home of impiety, in which Christ is daily blasphemed? Indeed, you must consider himself no less guilty than this poor bishop, at least to the extent that he has made no concealment of his wish that all synagogues should be destroyed, that no such places of blasphemy be further allowed to exist. The emperor finally flexed under the pressure when he was threatened with refusal of Ambrose to administer the church sacraments to him. So on the screen, I'll show you the progression here. We have first, synagogue burning is forbidden. That's where we start around that time. You can't do it. You can talk poorly about the Jews. You can write about them like the church fathers did, but we're not going to burn the synagogue. That's just not something that we should be doing. That's not the Christian thing to do. 338, big incident in Mesopotamia. A bishop, a Christian bishop, a leader in the church, and a mob of Christians burn a synagogue. The emperor Theodosius, the same guy who was responsible for the gathering of that code, the Theodosian code, with good and bad laws against the Jewish people, about the Jewish people, emperor Theodosius disapproves. You can't do that. You cannot burn a synagogue. St. Ambrose, Bishop of Milan, rebukes him in a letter, which is a little longer than this. He says, no, I'm sorry. There's nothing wrong with it. Theodosius is not too happy about it, and he fights back a little bit. But eventually, he goes to a cathedral for a service where St. Ambrose is the head of the cathedral, the head of the church at that time. And he caves in and sets a precedent because the bishop refuses to administer the sacraments to him, which to him would have meant probably that he would lose his salvation or go to hell. So no communion, no nothing. He would say, if you don't rescind on your decision to force the bishop and the followers of the bishop to rebuild at their own expense, no sacraments for you. So he caves in and sets a precedent. Synagogue burning is legitimized. So we go from forbidden to legitimized within a few years, because that set a precedent. Hey, if we can do it under this guy, and it's done by a bishop and Christians, then people in the villages, people that are uneducated, people that don't really go to church, are scared to death of anything Christian because they're going to go to hell, they don't understand, they have to pay the indulgences, the Catholic Church set up of how to make money and control people. They don't know, they just know what they get from the few of them that are educated that tell them what they hear from church. So all they know is that it's okay by Christianity to burn synagogues. It's been done and there was no discipline. So it legitimizes it, and from this point on, it's going to become a reality. Simply because the bishop, the emperor, flexed by fear of his own relationship with God. And he thought, well, you know, it's not that important to me, but I want to make sure that I can have the sacraments administered to me. So there was kind of a little bit of a flicky way of looking at it. But this is what made this little event made synagogue burning, which was just one event. You have Talmud burning, you know, holy books burning. You have, and it gets worse after that. But the synagogue burning, this was a critical event in the history of the Jewish people at that time. So on the last note here, page 8, ideological and intellectual opposition had turned to pure hatred and stereotype. The Jews were no longer just wrong. They had become evil and cursed by God to remain a witness people for all eternity. An ethnic component was added to anti-Judaism. Being Jewish in a Christian world went from bad to worse, but unfortunately for the Jewish people, anti-Semitism was still growing and had not reached its apex yet. The world was entering into the Dark Ages, and it would turn out to be quite a bit darker for the Jewish people. We went from Jewish people at the closing of the Bible, the closing of the canon, all the way through the 400, mid-400, we went from them being wrong and having it simply a theological disagreement between Christianity and Judaism. They went from being wrong to being evil. And that's a big shift. Up to now, they're wrong. Now they're becoming evil. Pretty soon, when you see pictures of Jewish people throughout the Middle Ages, they have horns, they have tails. They are representation of the devil. That's for next time when we start section 2. But now, there is a shift here from being wrong and simply anti-Judaism. Christianity does not agree with Judaism. That's up to the 400. It starts to get a little violent here. Now, we don't agree with you, but we also want to get rid of you. Not just changing you. We want to cut you off from society and eventually kill you if we can. So that's the progression, if it makes any sense. Let me stop this.